From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Like Effect. I'm Stephanie Lecce. Today on the program, we're showing off some great Milwaukee spots to visit, starting with the Soldier's Home. Then we're off to the Wisconsin Museum of Quilts and Fiber Arts in Cedarburg to look at their latest exhibit.
They called us and they said, would you like to have this exhibit? And we said, we sure would. We are kind of excited because I'll bet these quilts have never been inside a barn before.
And we'll take a short road trip to 11th and Kilbourne to visit the Chudnow Museum of Yesteryear.
We've just left the Wonderland Park and the ice cream fountain, and now we've walked to the neighborhood hardware store. And so we're showing off some of the hardware items that would have been available for people to buy at the time period.
Plus, we glide on over to a local skate park. Lake Effect is next after the news from NPR and Milwaukee Public Radio. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Stephanie Lecce. Thanks for being with us today. Milwaukee's Soldier's Home was founded in the wake of the Civil War to care for injured and recovering veterans. Today, the site spans 90 acres on the grounds of the Clement J. Zablocki VA Medical Center and is the oldest remaining soldier's home in the country. While many of the historic buildings are still in use by the VA, several have fallen into disrepair, and a recent report by the National Trust for Historic Preservation reiterates the call to preserve what it describes as national treasures. In recent years, efforts have been underway to preserve these buildings through the National Trust, the Wisconsin Historical Society, and other local and regional actors. We've been tracking those efforts. And recently, the Soldier's Home launched a walking tour smartphone app to draw residents out to the site to see these historic buildings. Jim Drager is the State Historic Preservation Officer at the Wisconsin Historical Society, and he took me on a tour of the grounds to see what progress is being made.
Many people know of the Soldier's Home, but very few have seen it. Most people's experience with it is seeing it from the parking lot of Miller Park when they're tailgating, and they look up and say, oh, what's that building up there? But to come up here, you see this very impressive group of historic buildings that are some of the finest architecture in the city of Milwaukee.
So let's start here with the building we're standing right in front of.
Sure.
What used to be housed here, and what's the new plan going forward once the preservation is complete?
Okay. The building that we're looking at is what's called Old Main Hall here. It was originally built as a domiciliary to house veterans of the Civil War. When this complex was established in 1867, right after the war, because it was realized that there were so many injured, disabled soldiers as a result of the war that the government had to do something to try to help these people. And it's the beginnings of the veterans care system that we have today. So 2 years after they established the VA hospitals, this building is built. And it's built to house veterans who are not able to go back into the general public because of the severity of their injuries or the amount of care that they needed. And so they stayed here in kind of barracks-like housing to receive the treatment that they needed.
What's the plan going forward?
The plan going forward is uncertain at this point. What we know is there is a need to have these buildings reoccupied. Exactly what that use will be hasn't been determined yet, but it's the most important historic building on the campus, and it's enormous. Looking at it, you see a very massive building, but I think what helps radio listeners understand it is it's 170,000 assignable square feet, so it's a gigantic building, and it will take gigantic uses to fill it.
While the renovation and the project planning is going on, how are you utilizing these buildings as they stand right now to bring the story of Soldier's Home alive?
Well, we're really trying to celebrate the history of Soldier's Home. Soldier's Home has recently been declared a National Historic Landmark, which is the nation's highest honor for historic buildings. It means that it's one of 50 properties in the state of Wisconsin that are considered to be seminal properties in telling the history of the United States. The Soldier's Home here in Milwaukee is the most intact of all of the VA hospital complexes in the United States. It's got most of its original buildings left here. And so we're trying to tell that story of continual veterans care over the years. I think, you know, as we think about our veterans' needs today and people who served in World War II or Korea or Vietnam or Afghanistan, Iraq, we're very aware of that story of the need to care for veterans who have put their lives on the line to serve our country. What we help to tell in this story is that this story has roots that go back deep into history, and that the soldier's home is the place where this kind of thinking about caring for veterans starts.
And how are you getting that story out now?
Well, we've created an app that is a walking tour of soldier's home, and it's available in a number of different formats. You can get it on the iTunes store. You can download it from the SaveSoldiersHome.org website. And you can take it around, and it will lead you around the complex and show you these really gorgeous, beautiful historic buildings.
Well, can you give me a mini tour, if you will, here?
Sure.
So we've looked at the main building here. What would be something we would hear on the walking tour about this main building?
I think one of the things that you would hear is that this was built in 1876. It had a number of additions over the years as the needs of veterans became greater. As these Civil War veterans are aging, more of them need service. So the building has to expand to follow that population's needs. And that it was designed by Milwaukee architect Edward Townsend Mix, who was probably the most famous architect in Milwaukee at the time, one of the best architects in the state. I think one of the really interesting things about this is that they hired not just any architect to design this. They hired Milwaukee's best architects to work on this complex, which tells you something about the level of commitment they had to the care of veterans. They really wanted the veterans to get the best care and the best environment that they could.
So where did the idea for the walking tour come from?
Well, we wanted to be able to help people to appreciate the Soldiers' Home complex. And the best way to do that is to allow them to stroll the grounds, because the part of the history of Soldier's Home, why it is where it is and why it looks the way it is that they recognized during the Civil War that they had to not just treat the body but the mind of veterans. So they created this beautiful landscape with all of these pastoral lawns and places to walk and places to relax and contemplate. So we wanted people to be able to get out here to appreciate the grounds and to see the architecture themselves. It's one thing to hear about the story of something. It's a whole other thing to see it. And so we wanted to have people be able to see in these buildings what we see, which is a great potential.
What's it like inside the buildings? You talked about how, especially in the main building, it was actually fairly well preserved. But I wonder, what do you see in there?
Well, if you go inside of the main building, you see something that looks probably a lot like an old school building. You see big, wide hallways. You see terrazzo floors, tile walls, large entrances, and then a series of rooms opening off of those hallways.
So where have we just arrived now?
We've arrived in front of the Soldier's Home Chapel, built in 1888. It was designed by a Milwaukee architect named Henry Cook, who is probably most famous to people in Milwaukee as the architect of the City Hall and the Turner Hall buildings in the downtown. And what we're looking at here is a wood frame, Queen Anne-style chapel building that's covered with shingles on the exterior, and has beautiful leaded glass windows and a lot of ornate detail.
What would be something that we would hear on the tour about the chapel?
On the tour, you'd hear how this chapel was financed through donations of veterans themselves. The chapel was built using proceeds of fines from deserters, from money that came through the store here on the grounds. When people bought stuff, the proceeds from it, the profit, went to support the construction of buildings on the grounds, including beer sales, which I think will make a lot of Milwaukee listeners happy. There are so many of the original buildings here that you can really get a feeling like you're traveling back in time. You can get a sense of what this was like when it was teeming with Civil War veterans in the 1870s, 80s, 90s. It has such a well-preserved complement of buildings that it's one of the places in Milwaukee that seems like it's lost in time.
Well, where to next?
I think we'll head on next to the Wadsworth Library.
I can see the value of preserving these buildings for the Historical Society in terms of not just the physical buildings themselves, but the stories that go along with them. But ultimately, what will all of this attention to the Soldiers' Home and its history bring to the modern-day VA?
I think what it will bring to the modern VA is the ability to be able to reuse these buildings in a way that supports the mission of the VA. We understand that their mission is not to operate a museum, that their mission is the service of veterans and veterans' medical needs. So that's why we're working very closely with them to try to make sure that any possible reuses of these buildings that come up are allied with their mission.
How many buildings are being targeted for there are 26 sites. Are all 26 being targeted for rehab and preservation?
There are four buildings that are currently unused by the VA that we are focusing our rehabilitation efforts on.
And so then some of the buildings, most of the buildings on the tour, are actually currently being used by the VA.
That's correct. This is a very busy campus. The VA has an enormous operation here, so having these many buildings here allows them for the opportunity to put all of the administrative uses and other kinds of uses that are a necessary part of patient treatment in places other than the hospital itself and free up hospital space for patient treatment.
Well, so I believe we've finally arrived here at the Wadsworth Library. Tell us about this building.
Sure. The Wadsworth Library was built as just what it sounds like, a library for the service of the veterans who are staying here at the hospital. This shows, again, the interest in treating the body and spirit of veterans and not just their physical injuries. So they constructed a library so veterans were able to educate themselves. It was part of the assimilation process for those veterans that would be returning to a more public life, and it was a necessary diversion for those who found themselves staying in permanent care here on the grounds.
And I see we've got some lovely Cream City brick here on the exterior.
Yeah, most of the buildings built in the complex are built of Milwaukee's own Cream City brick, so this yellow brick is everywhere in the complex, and it's a feature that defines all of the buildings here, virtually all.
Now, is this still a library?
This building's still being used as a library today, and it has some of the surviving details related to its use as a library. It has its terrazzo floors and plaster walls and a mezzanine area. Some of the original bookshelves that occupied the building are even inside yet today.
Now, obviously, we're not going to go to every stop on this tour. I think we've hit a couple of really great main sites, but there are so many others to see. What's your favorite spot on the walking tour?
My favorite spot is actually the Ward Memorial Theater, which is just down the hill from where we are right now, which was built as a theater space for veterans. And I think what's really interesting is they finished the dormitory spaces to house the veterans, and then one of the first buildings they built after that was the theater, because they understood that veterans had to be entertained as well, and they had to provide something for them.
Now, obviously, some partners have gotten to see the inside of the building. What would we see if we were in there today?
If you walked inside of it, you'd see a large theater space that is very historic and very original to its appearance. They have original wrought iron theater seats with the bent wood backs and seats, ornamental plaster walls, murals, and a very large proscenium arch over theater performing space.
Is this building going to be similar to the chapel in the sense that the rehab, the reuse of this building will try to keep that original character, but it might be used for something completely different than its original purpose?
Yes, the intent is to reuse this building, but do it in such a way that we preserve the character-defining features of the theater so someone can recognize that it was a theater and see all of the special aspects of the theater design yet. This may be the first building to be reused of the buildings that are currently vacant. The VA is looking at some possible reuses of this that will not be performing reuses, but will serve their current patient needs.
Jim Draeger, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jim Drager is the State Historic Preservation Officer at the Wisconsin Historical Society. He took me on a tour of the grounds to show off the new Walking Tour smartphone app. You'll find more about it at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. A Cedarburg museum is one of only three U.S. hosts for a visiting Japanese exhibit. We'll visit the Wisconsin Museum of Quilts and Fiber Arts when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Stephanie Lecce. Tucked away in an 1850s farmstead off Portland Road in Cedarburg is the Wisconsin Museum of Quilts and Fiber Arts. It's one of the few museums in the country dedicated to the art, craft, and preservation of these materials. It hosts exhibitions, conducts classes for adults and children, and fosters research into antique fiber arts both from Wisconsin and around the world. Local, national, and international pieces make up the museum's current show, Japanese Influences in Fiber Arts. The basis of the exhibit is 33 award-winning quilts from Japan's largest quilt guild competition. The rest of the show contains pieces that have been influenced by Japanese design. Lake Effect's Bonnie North met exhibition curator Luella Doss and executive director Melissa Rahlstad in the museum's barn gallery, and Doss explained how the Japanese exhibit came to Cedarburg.
There are three really great museums here in the U.S., many more than that, actually, but we were the ones who were selected to do this, and the first one was Paducah, which is the National Quilt Museum, and they called us, their friends, and they said, would you like to have this exhibit? And we said, we sure would. We are kind of excited because I'll bet these quilts have never been inside a barn before. But don't you think they look magnificent here?
They really do. Just the colors and the different shapes, and we'll talk about some of them. But I think a lot of people might not think of Japan as a center of quilting. It seems to be such an American thing.
They actually have three Japanese magazines about quilting, and it has swept the country. You can see here there are examples of traditional work, very much like American work, like the pieced houses or the Baltimore album quilt, Japanese style. But, you know, not all of these quilts are from Japan. Many of them are from Israel, Korea, the United States. So this is an international exhibit that is held by the Japanese Handcraft Association in Japan. And this was the 11th annual contest. And the two quilts that you see when you first walk into the gallery are the two winners. And one is a traditional winner and one is a contemporary winner.
I'm looking at the one that I am assuming is the traditional winner. That is
because
just an amazing.
This is made by Matsuko Morishita. She went to a foreign land and she looked up in the sky and she saw stars. And you know, with the big population they have in Japan, you don't often get to see the night sky. She was so enamored with this that she wanted to capture that with her fabrics. But you know, she used a Japanese star. And that translated, and you can see the Milky Way melting through her delicate patchwork. What I think is really exciting is that this quilt has come to a place that is right under the path of the flying goose. And all around this is a spiral of flying geese pattern. So it seems right that it should be here.
Now, is this all hand-worked, or
yes,
is this both machine and hand?
It's probably mostly machine, because as soon as women got machines in the United States and the world, they didn't do all. But I would imagine that it's some of each, and it's one step at a time, undoubtedly, in order to get this gradation of color and light and dark and illumination that you see in this quilt. It would take a great deal of work by hand.
Now, how long, even with machine, would something like this take? Do you know the amount of time she spent on this?
Well, it depends if you want to eat or make meals.
Assuming that you have a regular life.
Everybody works at their own space and their own style. So that's the wonderful thing about quilting, and that's what's keeping it alive, is that there is a great deal of freedom to pursue your art or your craft with whatever your lifestyle is. If you are traveling on a plane a lot, then of course you'd be doing a lot of handwork. And you'd get done pretty fast, just even though you're doing it by hand as opposed to the sewing machine. So it's hard to say just how long it would take someone to do a piece.
Now, do you happen to know if this particular woman is a professional in this, or is this just something she does out of love of it?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question because we were not given that much information. But I will tell you that the Japanese Handcrafts Association is in storefronts in little towns or in little neighborhoods in Tokyo and so forth. And I was actually there and I saw these little spots. It's just like going into a store here or right in your own neighborhood. And you go there to experience whatever craft that you're interested in. It might be tamari balls, which is something that we have, which are a thread ball that has a magnificent, intricate design on it. It may be knitting. It may be any of the fiber arts or textiles or painting or all manner of arts and crafts are done by the Japanese Handcrafts Association. So this brings it home to the hometown.
Now, what is this beautiful little piece that's hanging under it? Because that is quite stunning as well.
This is called Tile Lines by Teresa Guy from Italy. So here is one that is an international quilt. And it won the Contemporary category, the Publish Awards, and the Magic Patch Award. It is cotton, silk, organza. It is machine pieced, hand appliqued, and machine quilted. Here you see tons of little cut squares with stripes to make a confection that is so pleasing to the eye. It would make a wonderful graphic in an office or in a home that would be pleasing to look at forever. That's what makes a great quilt, by the way, is that every time you look at it, you see something different.
It seems that a lot of this kind of quilting, the modern quilting, has moved from the practical, where women were making quilts to keep warm,
yes,
to where it's actually art as opposed to just something practical.
It depends on the aesthetic of the individual creating the quilt. For example, back in the day, the Amish people made quilts that were really recognized as the first art hung on the wall in America, and help transform the station of the quilt to an art form in a new and different way because of the great art graphics of the Amish design, heart. You know, it's what comes out of your heart. Here you see an expression of this person's idea of beauty. And it goes from the light down to colors. It goes from whites and neutral tones to color. And maybe that says something about what this person's idea of philosophy of life is.
You know, I hadn't noticed that until you said that, yes, it's going from the white down to a much more saturated.
And you know, maybe that's the way her life has gone. Maybe it was simple at first, and now her life is much more complex, more colorful, has many more interrelationships that the color represents. But it's fun to think about it.
Exactly. It's like, well, with any artist, you want to know.
Yes, kind of when you go to a gallery, you like to go and you think about the artwork that you're viewing and where that person was who created it when they were creating it. What were they trying to express? And that's a lot about what modern quilts are. And that's what we're going to have next year at the museum is a wonderful exhibit of modern quilts called Modern Perspectives. And that's a way that people can learn what's happening new in quilting today, because it goes on.
Right. I think a lot of people might think that it's an old-fashioned craft and art, and it seems like that's not true.
Well, that's what these modern quilters are doing. They're taking the traditional patterns, and they're twisting them a little bit, examining what is in the background in the negative space and well as what is in the positive ground. So it's a new examination. It's a new generation, and we all embrace that.
So tell me, speaking of new, this is the modern one.
This is the contemporary one.
Yeah.
And it's called Grasslands by Mikiko Misawa. And Mikiko would go into an area where there's a mountain in the background, and there were all these grasses in the foreground. And the sun would shine on the grasses in a unique way, and she saw different colors, and she saw rhythms, and she saw the juxtaposition of the mountain in the background with the cragginess and the different points of of rock. And in the front was this very totally different soft feel of rhythm and the grasslands and the different colors that would play when the light shone on them in different ways. And she would go to this mountain many times in the year. So what she did is she abstracted the grass, and she selected fabrics that were, the warp was one color and the weft was another. And it gave it a shimmer, an iridescence that translated to her a new meditation. And she wanted to capture that on this, the surface of this quilt. And so she chose Thai silks because they are woven in that way. And then in the background, the relief of the quilting designs on top, some are very fluid and some are a bit craggy to capture that feeling of the hard rock in the background.
One of the things I love about this is, yes, the fabrics are beautiful, but looking at the stitching that goes through it, that gives you that sense of movement.
Absolutely.
And it's so intricate that I'm thinking of what it would have taken to actually plan out that stitching, to actually think about how that was going to look and how it was going to work.
Well, I'll tell you, sometimes it's all in process. And that's the exciting thing about creating, is that you have to have faith and trust in what is going to come next. Sometimes if you don't know what's going to come next, you have to do something that is repetitive or something you really didn't want to do. But in essence, what that does is that gives your mind and your hands and your heart a minute to kind of process and say, yes, that's what I'm supposed to do next, and away you go. And I think that almost all people who create on this level go through these different levels of knowingness of what is going to be next and positioning the different colors and all the heat that you see in the middle there and the parts that are not so busy. It's electric. This piece is electric, is it not?
Absolutely.
And so it's fun to think about, well, you know, there's light, there are shadows in this. There is bright light. There is vibrant color. There's an electricity going on here that Mikiko has created in spades.
I want to quickly bring you into this and just ask, you know, what the logistics were like to get something like this put together for the museum.
It took a fair amount of coordination between our museum, the Wisconsin Museum of Quilts and Fiber Arts, the New England Quilt Museum, the National Quilt Museum, which are the three hosting sites in the United States. But also, as Luella mentioned, I mean, the show was created initially by the Japanese Handicraft Instructors Association in Japan. So email was an absolute must with this because they're in Japan. We were working with a contact there, working with shipping companies here in the United States, and then coordinating between three different museums. So it did take quite a bit of coordination, quite a bit of effort in order to get it here. But as Luella mentioned before, we have a great working relationship with the other two museums, and we're developing this wonderful relationship now with the Japanese Handicraft Instructors Association. So it's actually been a wonderful partnership between four different organizations scattered across the world.
Much to see. And I want to thank all of you for coming in on a day off. I know that the museum is closed today, but thank you so much for letting me come in and see this and for talking with us.
Thank you so much. We're so glad you came.
Yep, thank you very much.
Luella Doss is the curator for Japanese Influences in Fiber Arts, the current exhibit at the Wisconsin Museum of Quilts and Fiber Arts in Cedarburg. Melissa Rahlstad is the museum's executive director. There's more of their conversation available online at wuwm.com/lakeeffect, and there's a link to the museum there as well. Another break now, and then we'll take a road trip to Milwaukee's Chudnow Museum of Yesteryear. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. More of Lake Effect now. I'm Stephanie Lecce. Today on the show, we're featuring places around the Milwaukee area we think you might want to visit. Wisconsin certainly has its share of fabulous museums that tell the story of the past, from the Milwaukee Public Museum to the Wisconsin Civil War Museum. But there's one museum where you can literally walk through Milwaukee history. The Chudnow Museum of yesteryear is only a year old itself, but it presents Milwaukee as it was in the interwar period and focuses on the material culture of the 1920s, 30s, and 40s. Located in a converted house at 11th and Kilbourne, the museum's rooms become the literal locales that show a city in transition. And each one is filled to the brim with historic tools, bottles, posters, and other seeming ephemera that were painstakingly collected and preserved by one Milwaukee man. A few months ago, director Steve Daly gave me a tour and explained the museum's origins.
This is the lifelong collection of one man, Abram M. Chudnow. And he was a local businessman who took it upon himself to collect Americana, basically, a social material culture of society. He collected all these different artifacts and objects that kind of document American culture. Kind of shows the consumerism, the rise of industrialization and the population during that time period.
And with the rise of that consumerism, there seems to be an increase in maybe that throwaway culture that Mr. Chudnow was kind of trying to preserve.
Yeah, for whatever reason, he decided early on to save the things that most of us would have put in the garbage a long time ago, like empty candy wrappers and cardboard boxes and tin cans. He saved them. And some of them he saved with contents still in them, and some of them luckily are empty, so we've had to discard some of the petrified contents out of some of the boxes or cans, but for the most part, most of them are empty.
Well, Steve, where are we standing right now?
Well, right now we're standing in our recreation of Wonderland Park, which was Milwaukee's version, if you will, of Coney Island or Six Flags. At one time, Milwaukee had this great amusement park that had a Ferris wheel, a carousel, roller coaster. It even had a water slide called Shoot the Chutes. It would have been in today's Hubbard Park if it was still around, but unfortunately there's no signs of Wonderland anywhere left. So what we're showing off in here is an ice cream parlor that would have been in Wonderland Park because they would have sold ice cream, and we're featuring Lueck ice cream, which was a major Milwaukee dairy at the time period, and John Lueck came up with two innovations for ice cream that really made Lueck a name in the nation. The first thing he did was came out with a process to freeze ice cream in bricks and put it in take-home cartons, much like a Chinese take-home box today. And the other thing was he came up with a process to make more than the standard strawberry, vanilla, and chocolate flavors. He came up with the idea, why can't we have fruits and nuts and things like that in ice cream? And before that time period, I guess it would mess up the machinery when you tried to add those things. Well, he came up with a way that he could do it, and other ice cream makers from across the nation came to visit him and learn how to do his process. So you can thank John Lueck for all your different chunky monkeys and cookie dough ice cream.
Why do this kind of three-dimensional recreation where you can literally sit on the stools, where people can actually put themselves into the scene?
We believe in the immersion exhibit, so where you can actually walk into it and experience the exhibit, much like the streets of old Milwaukee were a little bit more than that, that you can walk into the store, you can walk into the location and see what's on display rather than just look through a window and see it that way. We've just left the Wonderland Park and the ice cream fountain, and now we've walked to the neighborhood hardware store. And so we're showing off some of the hardware items that would have been available for people to buy at the time period. And some of the major things in this exhibit are the electrical objects. The United States was going through a massive electrification process at the time period. Everybody wanted electricity. And obviously, if you create a new product like electricity, there's companies that come along and create a demand for electricity. So you create electric toasters, you create electric irons, percolators, egg cookers, pants pressers, you name it, they make it. So we're just showing off some of those products that became available in the 1920s.
What is it about objects like these that help you to bring people into the past, to tell them these stories about what Milwaukee was like at this time period?
It's my opinion that it's through these objects that we can tell the story better because, for instance, showing a toaster, everybody can relate to a toaster. Although ours looks much different than your modern toaster, once we describe how it works, you get the general idea of the principle involved, or the coffee maker, or the electric iron. It's just a way of showing people that this is how history goes, and I think that's a way to do it with three-dimensional objects like this. And we're fortunate that Mr. Chudnow saved a lot of this stuff that probably would have long time ago ended up in the landfill somewhere.
As we're finishing our errands, we've just gone to the hardware store. Where are we now?
Now we've walked into the local neighborhood grocery store, and this is the H. Groffman Grocery Store, which is the other side of the Chudnow family. Mr. Chudnow was married to Anita Groffman, and this was her parents' grocery store at 603 Valete Street. This would have been a place that you would have shopped almost every day. There were ones throughout the city. I think they estimate there were like 260 neighborhood grocers throughout Milwaukee in the 1920s. They all catered to their clientele, so there were German grocers, there were Polish grocers, Italian grocers. We feel that during the Depression, it's probably because of grocers that keeping people on the books. You know, they didn't have credit cards back then, but because they let people buy things and take it home, but just keep it on the book, so to speak, not pay for it, but pay for it hopefully in the future, that they kept a lot of families fed, because if it wasn't for them, a lot of families probably would have gone hungry. So they let them carry their bills for months at a time before they paid it off.
I'm really impressed at the fact that Mr. Chudnow had this vision that he would keep some of these things.
Yeah, I mean, it's incredible that somebody had that kind of vision, and I think we're fortunate there are people like that who seem to recognize, for whatever reason, they seem to recognize that somebody needs to save this stuff, because most of these items in here would have been thrown out long ago. I mean, let's face it, how many of us would have saved an old Quaker Oats carton or a Carnation malted milk box or a Red Star yeast box or whatever? I mean, we would have thrown those out a long time ago, but he saw the need to collect and save these things. He labeled himself a conservator. That's what he called himself. And I think that's probably a pretty apt term for him. I mean, I think he felt like he was conserving this stuff for the future, and I think he really did.
Well, where to next?
Well, the next room we're going to walk into is our transportation exhibit. We've got a recreation of Union Depot, which was the Chicago, Milwaukee, and St. Paul Railway Depot that was sort of in the Menominee Valley area, sort of around Pottawatomie Bingo in that general vicinity. And so we're showcasing transportation and the various changes that happened in the 1920s. The car starts to slowly take over and the train starts a slow decline that doesn't stop until about the 1960s.
Tell us about who we're looking at.
Well, we have a porter, an African-American porter, and what we're showing here is the African-Americans' participation in the Porters Union, the United Brotherhood of Railroad Workers. And this is a big deal for African-Americans because this was a prime job if you were an African-American male. This was a good middle-class job for African-Americans at a time period when a lot of them were basically relegated to basically hard physical labor, and they didn't make a whole lot of money. Whereas an African-American porter, he made about $875 in 1920s money, which at the time period was a little bit below the average worker. I think they made about $1,200, so he wasn't making quite as much, but it was still a significant amount for an African-American worker. And they were looked upon in their neighborhood as being a role model for people. You know, that was a prime job, and they were kind of considered a person who had made it. They had made the American dream.
Who else was living in Milwaukee at this time?
Well, Milwaukee was made up of a lot of different ethnic groups: Germans, Poles, Irish, Italian, Eastern Europeans, Irish. You know, so it was a mixture of people. Germans probably the most numerous at the time period, but at the end of the First World War, Milwaukee started to lose its identity as a German city. Before that time period, German was spoken on the streets. They had German newspapers. They had German plays, operas. After the First World War and during the First World War, a lot of that changed. Obviously, they had to keep a lower profile.
Now let's take a trip to Bayview. We're going to Bayview Drugstore. What do we see here in this room? What is on display here?
Well, what we've recreated in here is a typical pharmacy from the 1920s. Medicine and pharmacy is undergoing a lot of changes in the 20s. Before 1920, there were a lot of patent medicines sold over the counter or through catalogs. And patent medicines were basically concoctions or elixirs that different companies sold to people that cured everything from hiccups to cancer. Honestly, most of them didn't do any of those things. And the three major ingredients that seemed to be in most of these concoctions were cocaine, heroin, and alcohol.
Wow.
So you can imagine that most of the patients who took these things were basically covering up the problem. They weren't really solving anything. And chances are, if you took it long enough, you probably became addicted to the elixir that you would take.
I guess that's one way to get a repeat customer.
Yes, the pharmacies would sell a lot of this stuff, or the catalogs would. But starting in the 1920s, the Food and Drug Administration started clamping down on the patent medicine companies for selling these products, and they started requiring that these ingredients, these three ingredients, would be either taken out, or the quantities or the strength of it would be lessened so that people wouldn't be receiving the doses that they were.
Well, I see that there's a clinic upstairs. Shall we head to that?
Yeah, we can go up to the second floor of the building, and you'll get a chance to see the other part of the house. This is the first room at the top of the stairs on the second floor. This was Dr. Joseph Eisenberg's clinic. And so what we're showcasing in here, at one time Dr. Eisenberg owned this building from about the mid-20s to about the mid-1950s, and he was a general practitioner who graduated from Marquette's medical school. We've documented that through some research. He operated it as a home clinic.
It's pretty interesting given where we're located, just a couple blocks from Aurora Sinai Hospital.
Yeah, I mean, we're in the neighborhood of a mega hospital, but back in the 1920s, there weren't a lot of those type of institutions, so a lot of these clinics or infirmaries kind of filled in for that when there was a need for people to be able to go somewhere and be taken care of.
Well, this next room is fairly colorful.
Yeah, what we're displaying in here are toys of the time period. So we've got a shop window here. We're calling it Grand Avenue Toys. You can use your imagination. It could have been Gimbel's or Schuster's, one of the big department stores at the time period. But it's showcasing some of the products that were available to the families at that time period. This was the advent of the board game. Families were able to spend more free time at home together playing games. With the eight-hour workday and the ability of mothers and fathers to make better incomes through different kinds of jobs, they didn't have to work long hours, they didn't have to work from sun up to sundown every night. They did have some free time to spend with their kids, and this was a chance for them to sit around the table, play a game, and get to know each other a little bit and find out that maybe dad has a sense of humor and mom's not such a bad person either, and find out what their kids are into. So it's a way to educate our visitors that mass production of games and consumerism, if you will, we're really kind of showing off consumerism here, that this was a way that the American family was kind of evolving in the time period.
Steve Daly is the director of the Chudnow Museum of Yesteryear, located right near 11th and Kilbourne. You can find more information from a link at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. You can also listen there to plenty more from our audio tour. One last break, and when we return, Lake Effect goes to the skate park. That's ahead on Milwaukee Public Radio.
They think there, a million hearts beat quicker there. No skies of gray on the gray.
Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Stephanie Lecce. The sounds you're hearing were recorded inside an old red brick building that thousands of us pass by every day and probably have never noticed. It's an old Wisconsin Electric building off I-94 near the campus of Marquette University. We're inside the Four Seasons Skate Park, which for more than a decade has launched the careers of some nationally competitive skateboarders, in addition to providing a place for casual skaters to ramp up their skills. Lake Effect's Dan Harmon and Nathan Royster spent an afternoon at the skate park and spoke with a couple of the people behind it. We hear first from Neil Levin, the founder and owner, who shares the history of the facility.
We opened in 1999. I had originally been living in Canada and had helped open a skateboard park in Canada at the time. I was in a different type of business, in a manufacturing business at the time. And one of my good friends had told me that there was a big void here in Milwaukee for an indoor skateboard park. So at the time, there was nothing. And he had owned a skateboard shop here in the city and had told me there's a lot of parents and kids coming in saying they would like an indoor place to ride. So he convinced me quite a bit, and I moved back in 99, and that's when I opened the skate park. I really felt like there was a need for it. There was a lot of people riding at the time, and there was no indoor place. So that's what sparked me to open the park.
And when you walk in here, it's really impressive. I mean, it's in an old building, I think you said, owned by Wisconsin Electric, or yeah. Used to be a right. If not a power plant, a power facility.
Right.
So how did you find this space? It seems like the perfect space, and we're going to put pictures on the website so people can see it, but it seems like really a perfect place for what you wanted to do.
Yeah, the space is great, and we had made a great deal of changes. When we first came into the space, it was used for metal fabricating. So in its inception, it was Wisconsin Electric. There are neighboring buildings that were used as well for that facility, but our facility at the time was a metal fabricating facility, so there were large cranes in here. And we had to do a lot of work, actually, in the building to get it to where it is now as far as this open span. There was one large crane that ran through the whole building that we ended up jackhammering out, and we poured new concrete floor, and we had to do a lot of work to get to the space that it is now. I mean, the character of the building is amazing. It does fit exactly so well for the use that we have. It gives us very little restrictions as far as what we want to build and the way that we can run things. So it gives us a lot of diversity, and that's a good thing for us. So, yeah, the building's amazing, so...
I just want to follow up because you said that the idea came to you because a friend of yours said there's nothing in Milwaukee that is like this, so there's no indoor skate park. So that's still a huge risk. I mean, why? You just took his word and moved here from Canada and dumped a lot of money into this place?
At the time, you know, I was working in Canada. I had owned my own company and decided to sell it and move back here. I had been involved in skateboarding my whole life. I was an amateur skateboarder, sponsored skateboarder. I traveled a great deal. I was pretty knowledgeable in what skate parks, what they were doing and how they were operating around the country because I had been to a number of them. And at the time, skateboarding was really booming again. It was really one of those things that was gaining a lot of momentum. And it was a huge risk. There's no doubt about that. But I kind of felt like having the support of the local shops and the people here, I felt like we made a more of a calculated risk. It's always a risk opening your own business, no matter what it may be. But I felt confident and comfortable that we were able to do it. So, you know, I knew the sport. I didn't know so much the business side of things till I really started doing it. But it was a gamble I'm glad I took.
We're here with Neo 11, owner of Four Seasons. Well, you just used the word sport, and that's something I wanted to find out is, are the people that come here just here to have fun generally, or are some of the skaters here actually preparing for competitions?
Well, when we first opened, skateboarding and BMX biking was just, like I said, gaining a lot of momentum back in that time. There were pros, and pros were doing pretty well at that time as well, making good money, making a good living skateboarding and BMXing. When I first opened, since we were so new and it was kind of the first time that there had been an indoor skateboard park here since the turf in the early 90s, I think people just came here as fun, not knowing what the future would hold. But as time went on and as kids were coming day in and day out and having a place that they could ride every day all year long, kids started getting really good and really be able to progress. And as they progressed, over time, we've turned out actually quite a few pros from the skate park over the 14 years that we've been in business. And some of them have done very well. They're competing in the X Games and the Dew Tour and the Maloof Money Cup. There's about five or six guys from this park alone that have competed there. There's actually guys from the skate park. One of them, Greg Lutzka, who is a pro skateboarder, has won gold at the X Games. He's done really well for himself. Also, a few bikers from the skate park have competed in the X Games and done really well. And they're all making a living doing this. At this point right now, it's not a huge percentage, but, you know, there are kids that are making a living out at this point, you know. But majority of our business comes here to have fun, obviously. I think most people that come here, they don't think of a future as far as getting paid in the sport, but they are here just to have a good time. And that's what we want them to come in and have. We want to have a great experience.
The other thing besides the building, when you come in and you get a kind of a panoramic view is, and we'll put a picture on the website of this as well, is the actual ramps themselves. And I asked you just casually, I wasn't even being serious, I asked you, well, did you make these all yourself? And you said, yes, all of these ramps are made by you, which I think is pretty amazing, because obviously they have to be smooth enough so that people aren't going to get injured or snag their wheels or, you know, anything could happen on them. So tell us about the design process. Are there a few set designs that you would find in any skate park? And then is there anything that is special to this one?
So I started building ramps. I'm 42 now. I started building ramps when I was about 12 years old. So I first experimented in my parents' basement and then in their driveways. So back in the day, there was really no blueprints or plans for you to build skateboard ramps. So you and your friends would just get together and kind of look or, you know, pause a video or see a picture in a magazine and try to, you know, look at that and see how things were made. And we just was by experiment. And over time, we learned how to build a ramp. And then over time, then people were putting out ramp plans. There are certain companies that were putting out ramp plans that you kind of follow. And over the years, I was building a ton of ramps. I mean, I had it in my own indoor little park with a buddy of mine. Back in the day, it was in a barn. So we used to build tons of ramps all the time there. And over time, you know, here we kind of just collected ideas from different riders, from BMX and skateboard. When we first initially designed the park, I got a lot of input. So it wasn't just me. I had taken a lot of the people from the area and said, look, what would you like to see in the skate park? You know, what are the key obstacles that you would like to see? And we kind of narrowed that down. We kind of narrowed it down because I'm a skateboarder. I'm not a BMX rider. So for our BMX side of things, I really had to go find people that, you know, knew what they were talking about and do the research. So, you know, I build everything, but I've had a lot of help, you know. Sometimes I won't even design the obstacle. Someone will come here and say, I really thought of this. This is a really cool obstacle that I'd like to see here. And we'll take it as a collective group and say, wow, this is really cool. Let's build that. So then we build it. So it's not always myself thinking everything up, but yeah, I always have a hand in building everything. And at the end of the day, the decision ends with me. But we try to open it up to a lot of different people because, you know, for me, I'm only riding a lot of transitional stuff, like the bowl, so I like to get a lot of input. So,
all right, Neil, thank you very much for coming on Lake Effect. It's a very impressive place.
I appreciate you guys coming out and taking a tour of the place. It means a lot to us. It's always good to get the word out about what we're doing and having people come and check out our space so people kind of know that it's here. And, you know, it's a good thing. I appreciate it very much. Thank you.
Neil Levin is founder and owner of Four Seasons Skate Park in Milwaukee. The place is full of ramps and jumps, but Levin talked with Dan Harmon from the edge of the skating bowl. That's another week's worth of Lake Effect. We're produced by Mitch Tyke, Bonnie North, and Dan Harmon with the assistance of Eleanor Peterson and Nathan Royster, the web support of Michelle Maternowski, and audio engineering by John Strelecki. I'm Stephanie Lecce. I hope you have a terrific weekend and tune in tomorrow and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend from WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next. So come and skate with me. Just a rebel looking for a place to be. So let's kick and push and coast. My man got a little older, became a